Hi, this is Gordon Deal. The Wall Street Journal this weekend starts right after this. In any business, it's important to maximize your potential, and strong communication and collaboration are key. It allows you to close deals faster, problem solve better, create new opportunities. That's why you need Citrix GoToMeeting. It's the best, most efficient way to meet with clients and customers from the convenience of your computer, smartphone, or tablet. With GoToMeeting, you can meet online as often as you like with anyone. Anywhere in the world, share screens to view documents and presentations together in real time. And use the built-in HD video conferencing feature to see each other face-to-face to engage and connect. It's just like being in the same room, even when you're miles apart. GoToMeeting allows you to cut out the wasted time and expense of travel so you can be more productive without losing that personal touch of meeting in person. Try GoToMeeting for free today to see what it can do for you. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free for 30 Days button, and use the promo code WSJ. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code WSJ.
Direct from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal, the Wall Street Journal This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
Jeb Bush comes out for the Common Core. I'm John Metaxas, in for Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti. The former Florida governor is taking a stand that could reverberate throughout the Republican primaries. Also in this hour,
it's been 20 years since the O.J. Simpson low-speed chase, and lots has changed since. In fact, lots has changed because of that.
Lost your keys? How about considering a lost item tracker? We'll tell you the best ones.
Why it's harder for first-time buyers to find a home these days.
And why breakfast cereal is not just for breakfast anymore.
Cereal companies are having a rough time. We're eating a lot less cereal, and it's sort of the first extended period in a while where sales have been down or flat for a little over a decade now, just gradually sort of dropping off.
All that and more on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. 7 minutes past the hour, I'm John Metaxas, in for Gordon Deal. Most potential Republican presidential candidates are coming out against the national educational standards of the so-called Common Core, but not former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. He's been for measuring academic achievement for two decades, and now he's embracing the Common Core. Beth Reinhardt of the Wall Street Journal has been following Bush's positions and joins us now on the T-Mobile hotline to tell us what this means for his national profile. Beth, tell us what this is all about.
Governor Bush has long been a champion of higher standards as two-term governor of Florida. He totally overhauled the education system and has continued to be very involved in education policy through his foundation. And as Common Core emerged in the last few years after he left office, his foundation has become a chief promoter of that, and he has as well. At the same time, there's been growing resistance to Common Core, which is a set of national academic standards. They're benchmarks in math and reading that says, you know, at this grade level, you should know this. There's been resistance growing to that. And as a result, you've seen one after the other of Republicans who are thinking about running for president turning against Common Core, either backtracking on their previous support or coming out against it. And so that leaves Governor Bush pretty isolated on the right if he decides to run for president in 2016.
I can imagine that his stance would have a different impact in the primary than in the general election. Is that right?
Right. I mean, the opposition to Common Core is coming from both sides of the political spectrum. But for Governor Bush, it would obviously be from the right, the conservatives that dominate presidential primaries, that would be a problem for him. It's possible, though, if he sticks with Common Core and is able to survive in the primaries, that he could emerge a stronger general election candidate. I mean, one thing that happens a lot is that candidates run toward their base, whether it's the left or the right, during the primaries, and then find themselves kind of scurrying back to centrist positions in a general election. If Governor Bush stays where he is, then he doesn't have to do as much repositioning.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Beth Reinhardt about what Jeb Bush's support of Common Core could mean for a potential presidential run. Could the fact that South Carolina has one of the early primaries pose a challenge to Jeb Bush?
It could. South Carolina is one of the states that had initially adopted Common Core and signed a law basically repealing it. So certainly that state is a hotbed for resistance to Common Core. The former Senator Jim DeMint, who now heads the Heritage Foundation, is an opponent of Common Core. So I think there would definitely be pushback in South Carolina.
What are some of the arguments we're hearing from the conservative side about why Common Core is not such a good idea?
These are national standards that lay out what a child at each grade level should know in math and reading. And what conservatives object to is tying those standards to federal education grants. And that's what President Obama did. He has a program called Race to the Top that gives out grants. And he said states that adopt Common Core can get a share of this money. And so conservatives who are very wary of federal incursion into local schools are concerned that with the money will come influence over curricula.
Could this be the main reason that conservatives might shy away from Jeb Bush, or are there other issues which they don't agree on?
You know, there is another key issue where he strays from conservative orthodoxy, and that's immigration policy. He favors legal status for undocumented workers. And as we've seen, that can be an issue in Republican primaries. So those are two issues that definitely animate the conservative base and could give him trouble if he runs in 2016.
Beth Reinhardt of The Wall Street Journal, thanks for joining us.
By 2025, it's estimated that half the world's population will lack access to safe drinking water. A sorry state of affairs, as two-thirds of our planet is covered by water. We are helping develop solutions for salt water to satisfy the thirst of future generations. BASF, the chemical company.
America was built by innovators and dreamers like you. To celebrate, LegalZoom dedicated this month to innovation by making it easy for you to file trademark or copyright applications, incorporate your business, or form an LLC. Call or visit LegalZoom.com. They'll provide the personal attention you need and help take care of all the details. For a limited time, get a special price on trademark and copyright applications by using the referral code WSJ at checkout. LegalZoom provides legal help through independent attorneys and self-help, but they're not a law firm.
We are 14 minutes past the hour. I'm John Metaxas in for Gordon Deal, and this week marked the 20th anniversary of the O.J. Simpson low-speed Bronco chase. Some of you remember that. In a commentary, MarketWatch's John Friedman this week has written that that single event broadcast on national TV changed everything. Our Gordon Deal spoke with John Friedman to get an explanation of what he means by that.
We're speaking with MarketWatch columnist John Friedman. He's got a piece about how 20 years ago, he's saying O.J. Simpson kicked off the fall of civilization. Explain what you mean here, John.
Yeah, what a shame, huh? It was so nice before all this happened. What happened was O.J. Simpson, of course, being a famous football player and advertising symbol in the U.S., became also the centerpiece of this investigation of these murders overnight. And everyone went haywire. Everything went haywire all of a sudden because the media kicked in, and the concentration of O.J. being a celebrity, a sports star, a TV star, a movie star, all this came to the fore, and this great celebrity, this famous person, became involved in this murder investigation, and the media decided to cover it 24/7 like nothing else we've seen before. Amy Fisher, forget it. Nothing compared to this.
Wow. How about, too, just several years before that, right, with the Gulf War? That was kind of, we had started going 24/7, right?
Well, that was real news. I mean, the Gulf War, obviously, was a global story involving business, politics, everything, and there were severe repercussions to this story. We didn't know what was going to happen with this story, with Saddam Hussein, all the rest of it, so that was a really important story. And it was a war, so obviously there was a lot at stake. But O.J. Simpson was a guy, a man, you know, involved in a terrible situation, obviously the murder of two innocent people. And we all felt horrible for those poor victims. But it was a murder story, which happens, unfortunately, sadly, every single day.
Yeah. And if that had been somebody we had never heard of who was in that white Bronco, story would have never made news.
If it had been O.J. Smith,
Yeah.
People would have thought, oh, that's a sad situation. Too bad for the victims. I'm sorry to hear that. But now, of course, and the slow chase, that was really the turning point. That was the tipping point of the whole thing. The slow chase going down the freeway in Los Angeles, showing this symbol, this sign, which never changed, of this car going down this highway. It brought so many ideas to the fore. What was so amazing about this all, as you can remember if you're a sports fan, was Game 5 of the Knicks-Rockets final series of the NBA was taking place that Friday night of the slow car chase, and nobody cared.
Yep.
People at the Garden were turning away to watch their monitors of the slow chase. The media weren't covering the game, they were covering the slow chase at the Garden. It was amazing.
Yep, we're speaking with MarketWatch columnist John Friedman. He's got a piece entitled, 20 Years Ago, O.J. Kicked Off the Fall of Civilization. I can remember that. I was at a bar watching that game, and all of a sudden all the TVs switched over to the slow chase.
And I mean, they're playing for the NBA championship, but nobody cared.
Yeah, yeah, with the Knicks, no less, right?
The Knicks,
with
of course, the New York team.
Yeah. You point out, too, which I think is fascinating, the tie-in, too, with Robert Kardashian, reality TV, and the Kardashian girls now.
Oh, my gosh, how things turn out.
Yeah.
Robert Kardashian was one of O.J.'s lead attorneys. And again, remember, this is a murder case, so there's a lot at stake here for this individual. It's not just a glamorous case of involving a divorce or, you know, a marital spat. This is a murder, so obviously there's a lot at stake here. And Robert Kardashian was a noted attorney in Los Angeles at the time. And now, of course, we know Kardashian as being the name of Kim Kardashian and basically the poster child for reality television gone amok.
What do you think happened to our minds or our expectations or that of television producers following that incident with O.J. Simpson?
Well, they saw the ratings and the circulation figures became so immense overnight that they figured this is great business. We've got to get into the business of celebrity culture. Even the New York Times at the time started following this story as a story beyond just a murder case. And the potential to get big audiences to read your stuff and to watch you on television became too tantalizing to turn down. And that led to so many other stories that titillated people over the years.
Yeah. Could this reverse, John, ever?
I don't see how. The business is too great to be in it. To turn your back on celebrity culture and cover the old-fashioned news is a great ideal. It's a high-minded idea, and I would love to see it, but I don't see how.
Well, I'm not even sure we have the journalistic training to do it. Cover real news.
We could do it. It's just a matter of is the potential there financially, and the answer is probably no.
Our Gordon Deal with John Friedman of MarketWatch. 20 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Here's Gina Cervetti.
Well, this next week we get some important updates on the economy, including the final estimate of first quarter economic growth. Stuart Hoffman at PNC says he expects growth to come in at an even slower pace than initial estimates.
It does appear as though it was a bit weaker than the initial estimate. So instead of being down 1% for GDP, I think we're going to probably be down 1.5%.
But he says that because of pent-up demand, the spring quarter should show growth of as much as 4%. Text messages supporting your efforts to quit smoking boost chances that you will kick the habit, according to federal research. It found that smokers using such a texting service were twice as likely to be free of the habit after 6 months compared with those who are given only reading materials. Do you read texts when stopped at the light on the road? A new Harris poll finds that 51% think it's okay to do that, 49% do not. Most people said texting while driving was dangerous. About 30% said they were more likely to drive after a few drinks when only going a short distance. A new TransUnion analysis finds that reporting rental payment history to credit bureaus in the same way that other payments are reported could have a positive impact on the credit of consumers considered risky bets. About 80% of those renters saw their credit scores rise a month into a new apartment lease when those payments were reported. Well, when it comes to eating out, we're choosing smaller restaurants over the larger chains, according to the American Customer Satisfaction Survey. David Van Amberg is managing director. He says consumers prefer quality more so than just value.
Here again, even in sit-down restaurants, we're seeing the same phenomenon, where actually the smaller restaurants, either small chains or your individual local restaurant, they're definitely getting much higher marks.
Again, that's the American Customer Satisfaction Index, and he says that big pizza chains are beating out other chains, such as sandwich shops. Well, where does it cost the most to diagnose and repair your check engine light? You know it's gone on more than once. In North Carolina, where the average is around $426, says CarMD, you pay the least in Nebraska at around $323.
I really hate that check engine light.
Gosh.
I mean, it's supposed to give you more control, but I think a shake or a rattle might give you more clue to what's wrong with your car than that darn light.
Yeah, and be honest, you've driven around for months with it on, right?
Yeah. We all know about that. Thank you, Gina. 22 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. 26 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. I'm John Metaxas in for Gordon Deal. And if you're like me, you'll often forget where you put your keys or your glasses and then spend an inordinate amount of time looking for them. Well, now, thanks to new Bluetooth tags, things like your keys, wallet, and purse may never go missing again. Joining us to explain this brave new world that's emerging is Wall Street Journal's personal tech columnist, Joanna Stern. She's going to tell us about the new tech category of lost item trackers. Joanna, how well do these things work?
There's one thing that all of these do, and that is they work really well in close proximity. That doesn't give you much space to move, right? So you're looking at about 100 to 150 feet. Now, if the device is connected in that range, you can click a button in all of the apps, and it will sound an alarm on the little device. So it's really good for finding something in your bag, right? And that's actually where I constantly cannot find things. So for women, this is a great thing to find in, you know, finding something in your bag. It's also really good for if the keys might be buried under something or some sort of item that you don't use that frequently is, you know, in a drawer that you keep in your house. So in those situations, when you're in those close proximity range, that's one of the things it can do. Two of the items actually also have this feature that when your phone is when it unpairs from that device, so let's say I leave my keys on the table and I walk out the door, it will sound an alarm on my phone. Now, that is a good idea in theory, but every time I walk away from my keys, that alarm is sounding.
And you can't adjust that to make it react differently?
Not yet. Many of these companies say they're working on more contextual clues. So this app knows more about, okay, you know, you're in the office and you just walked away from your keys. It's okay. You know, we're a little bit of a while away from that. I mean, it's easy to silence those alarms. But one of the interesting things about the Tile and the tracker is that they have these crowd searching features. And when I leave my work ID at my office and I go home, if a colleague of mine comes to the office and has the Tile or the Tracker app on, and that little dongle's attached to the work ID that I left at my desk, those will actually help tell me back at my apartment that somebody has spotted that lost item at the office.
We're on the phone with the Journal's Joanna Stern. So, Joanna, does this thing chirp every time someone walks past that happens to have the same utility?
It just updates on the map. On the map in the apps, in both Tile and Tracker, it says, this was last seen 2 minutes ago, or this was last seen at, you know, 48th and Park at 6:05 p.m., But you're relying on people who have this app. And right now, you know, this isn't a great solution if you think you drop your keys on the train and somebody mm-hmm. comes and sits down. I mean, it's going to be many lucky things that happen there. But in the case of, you know, that your partner, your spouse has this app in the house, you want to know if you left the wallet or something like that. This is kind of preventing the call. Like, can you see if I left the keys on the kitchen table? Can you see if I don't have my glasses on and I don't know how I got to work? So, you know, it is an interesting concept, and it's really just in the infancy right now.
All right. Thank you, Joanna, personal tech columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Joanna Stern. We're 30 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Coming up, the housing market is getting a lot tougher for first-time buyers.
When I was pregnant, I got more advice than I knew what to do with. What I needed was information I could trust on how to take care of me and my baby. Luckily, United Healthcare has a simple program that helps moms stay on track with their doctors and get the right care and guidance before and after the baby is born. Simple is good right now.
Innovations that work for you. That's health in numbers. United Healthcare.
America was built by innovators and dreamers like you. To celebrate, LegalZoom dedicated this month to innovation by making it easy for you to file trademark or copyright applications, incorporate your business, or form an LLC. Call or visit LegalZoom.com. They'll provide the personal attention you need and help take care of all the details. For a limited time, get a special price on trademark and copyright applications by using the referral code WSJ at checkout. LegalZoom provides legal help through independent attorneys and self-help, but they're not a law firm.
Powered by the most trusted name in journalism, you're listening to The Wall Street Journal This Weekend.
Coming up on The Wall Street Journal This Weekend, cities across the country are vying for the Obama Library, pitching cereal for dinner, and shuffling off to Buffalo on vacation. It's 34 minutes after the hour. I'm John Metaxas, in for Gordon Deal, along with Gina Cervetti. As the housing market gains steam, it's leaving first-time homebuyers behind. Unemployment, student loan debt, rising home prices, they're all making it difficult for many first-time homebuyers to get mortgages. But June also marks the peak of real estate season. Frank Keating is former Oklahoma governor and now president and CEO of the American Bankers Association. He joins us to discuss the current housing market. Governor Keating, this is no easy time for the first-time buyer. Please tell us what they might do for themselves.
Well, this is American Housing Month, so those of us who think owning a home is the first rung and an important first rung on the economic prosperity ladder in the United States, we're waving our little homeownership flags. But because the economy is soft, because young people, first-time home buyers, have, in many cases, a lot of student loan debt, some $1 trillion in student loan debt out there, and because of the soft economy, a lot of starting salaries are rather modest, this is a time of sharp penciling if you want to buy a house. One thing that concerns me as a dad and a granddad is home ownership among young people has declined 15% since it peaked in 2005. College graduates now have $25,000 in student loan debt. That's a ton of money. And unemployment is at 11% for 20 to 24-year-olds. So if you're in that category, but you do have a job, then what is your credit score? I mean, do you pay your bills? Do you have too much credit card debt? That all has to be looked at and worked through in order to successfully buy a house. But a home is not an ATM machine, but it is a piggy bank. It's a wonderfully important asset to have, and we think this month is a good time to shop around. Interest rates are very, very low, as you know. This is a good time to shop around, but you need to be very careful and think selfishly, defensively as you do so.
If you're a first-time home buyer, say in your 20s, should you expect that a potential seller might demand more of a down payment from you?
That seller may say, well, look, I'll sell you this house, but I want your dad and mother to co-sign the note. I mean, things like that do happen. But what is really important is to have young people understand that the best asset remains a home. I know it takes a while on occasion to sell a house, but it is certainly a lot better than paying rent. But because of student loan debt, and I hope people are very careful about taking on too much student loan debt, and the debt they take on will not result in them not being able to find a job because the degree is worthless. And that sometimes happens. That college degree that they have isn't a major or a subject area that just simply doesn't permit them to have much of a future income in that particular profession. So, you know, people really need to talk to their best friends, their mother and dad, people who they really trust in matters such as this, to get the best idea going forward so that the decision that you do make, the section of town you live in, what are the commuting costs, the transportation costs, what are the fees and the points you have to pay for the loan, how about a realtor's commission, how does that factor in the price of the house? All these are things that people need to talk about, debate about, discuss sensibly and intelligently before they make this leap. But it's a great leap. You will swim a long way with a house, but you need to make sure you don't hit the rocks as you go in.
We're speaking with Frank Keating. He's the president and CEO of the American Bankers Association, also the former governor of Oklahoma. It seems impossible today to save with all of the debt college students face. What should they do?
It's just a good time to make decisions to buy a home, but it's a good time to take a real hard look at your personal finances and also your future, because young people have a big, long, wonderful future in front of them, but they need to be very, very careful. And that's where adult leadership, your banker as your best friend in this process to sit down and get their guidance and advice. Bankers want to make the loan. Bankers want you to be a customer, but they need to make sure you can pay it back, and you need to make sure you can pay it back as well.
Frank Keating, former Oklahoma governor and president and CEO of the American Bankers Association, thanks very much for joining us. 39 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. 41 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. I'm John Metaxas in for Gordon Deal. The competition for Barack Obama's presidential library is heating up. Columbia University in New York City, where Mr. Obama did his undergraduate work, and Hawaii, the president's birthplace, are likely to file proposals by Monday's deadline for the first round of potential sites. But they're likely to get stiff competition for bids coming out of Chicago's South Side. That's because of the deep connections the Obamas have with the Windy City. Mark Peters of the Wall Street Journal has been following the competition and joins us. Mark, it looks like it's going to be in Chicago, correct?
We are coming to the first step in the decision on the presidential library. I think a lot of people would say Chicago has the upper hand right now because of the deep connections to both Mr. Obama and the First Lady. But it will be a competition in the months ahead. There are bids coming from outside of Chicago, and also there's bids within Chicago, neighborhood to neighborhood, that would like to host this facility.
Who ultimately makes the decision?
Ultimately, he and Mrs. Obama make the decision. It will go through his foundation. They'll whittle or narrow down the selections, and then he and the First Lady will decide, likely sometime early next year, we're being told.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Mark Peters. Putting the presidential library on the south side of Chicago would really benefit these communities, wouldn't it?
It really, the thought is that the presidential library really could bring a lot of things to a community. You get the prestige of the library, obviously, but also there's a lot of money that will come with it and tourists that will come with it. The idea is that there could be programs for the local neighborhood at the library, I've been told. There also is likely transportation money for better bus lines, better rail service, things like that that could come with it as well. And also, you could get hundreds of thousands of people there visiting from around the world each year. So there's a lot to be gained if you can land this library, and that's why there's competition between parts of the city to be its host.
Is the construction of this presidential library unique because Mr. Obama is a historical president in many ways?
I think what may be unique to some degree about this is it's likely going to be put in one of the largest American cities, and it's also likely going to be used to do some redevelopment in that city. The other contenders that we know of are Honolulu, where the president was born, and also Columbia University in New York City, where he attended undergraduate. So, and he is a historic president, and it likely will make his a very popular library. If you look at stats that the federal government puts out, these libraries tend to, the presidents you think would draw heavily tend to draw heavily. You see a lot of draw to Kennedy, to Reagan, to Clinton. Presidents like Hoover and Carter, you see less of a draw. And the Obama Library will likely benefit from being in a large urban area as well.
All right. Very interesting. Mark Peters of the Wall Street Journal, thanks for joining us. We're 44 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend.
Traveling overseas for business comes with a checklist of things to worry about. But with T-Mobile, you can take getting international data off that list. Because with a simple choice for business plan, unlimited data in over 100 countries is automatically included at no extra charge. Only at T-Mobile.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
America was built by innovators and dreamers like you. To celebrate, LegalZoom dedicated this month to innovation by making it easy for you to file trademark or copyright applications, incorporate your business, or form an LLC. Call or visit LegalZoom.com. They'll provide the personal attention you need and help take care of all the details. For a limited time, get a special price on trademark and copyright applications by using the referral code WSJ at checkout. LegalZoom provides legal help through independent attorneys and self-help, but they're not a law firm.
48 minutes past the hour. I'm John Metaxas in for Gordon Deal. Cereal, it seems, is not just for breakfast anymore. At least that's what the cereal companies want us to believe. And more of us may, in fact, be eating more cereal at off hours than ever before. Our Gordon Deal sat down with the Wall Street Journal's Sarah Nassauer to find out what's behind this new marketing push.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Nassauer about cereal companies targeting cereal eaters. Meaning what here, Sarah?
Cereal companies are having a rough time. We're eating a lot less cereal, and it's sort of the first extended period in a while where sales have been down or flat for a little over a decade now, just gradually sort of dropping off. And cereal companies now are getting a little bit more creative about who they're targeting. And so for the first time, they're really reaching out to what they call off-breakfast eating, which is having cereal for dessert, having cereal for dinner, using it as a snack. And that has to do with the idea that sitting down for breakfast takes a little bit too long for a lot of people these days.
You know, that reminds me of the old orange juice campaign. I forget who did it, but remember, orange juice isn't just for breakfast anymore?
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
So
yes.
Why are sales down? Any reason why sales are down?
Several reasons. One is that we're really kind of obsessed with eating more protein. Americans are, even though the average American eats more protein than they need.
Yeah.
And that's become pretty acute at breakfast. We're going for Greek yogurt and fast food egg sandwiches and protein bars, and cereal doesn't necessarily come to mind when people think of protein. And portability. People want to eat in their cars. They want to eat while they're running around the house doing things, getting ready in the morning, and cereal isn't always eaten that way. And so, for example, General Mills now is running an ad up for Lucky Charms, and it shows a man, 30-something man, walking through the house eating a bowl of Lucky Charms, and that was pretty controversial internally because it showed a person walking, not sitting down, enjoying a bowl of cereal as one should. But they decided, hey, we need to embrace this behavior.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Nassauer about what cereal companies are up to since sales have been down. What about just the ingredients of cereal? Are a lot of people turned off because, you know, the selections are not great in terms of the amount of sugars that are in these things?
Sugar has been a really hot button issue on cereals and definitely has hurt sales. You know, this idea that kids' cereals are too sugary has been out there now for years, and, you know, health advocates have really made them a target. They have gone through this round of reducing the sugar in cereals, though some would say a lot of that is under 10 grams per serving. A lot of critics would say kids eat more than one serving when they sit down, so they're not always just eating those 10 grams, and that's still a lot. I think, though, what really has hurt them is this protein idea. Even if you might be willing to except the sugar, if you're getting the protein.
Okay.
You know, the consumer isn't always logical, but that seems to be what's going on.
Okay. Who else is doing something here that we might recognize?
Well, there's a lot of sort of funny marketing things that are being done to try to solve this. One thing that I thought was kind of amusing was General Mills had an insight. They do a lot of research on consumers that late night video game players really like Cinnamon Toast Crunch. And so, you know, that's something they might not have spent a lot of money going after in the past. And now they sponsored a video game conference last year in LA specifically based on that. When the PlayStation 4 was released last winter, did a lot of tweeting with gamers, you know, in the middle of the night that were up waiting for it to be released. So they're just capitalizing on these funny little behaviors they didn't pay much attention to before.
Our Gordon Deal speaking with Sarah Nassauer of the Wall Street Journal. 51 minutes past the hour. Once again, here's Gina Cervetti.
Well, this next week brings an update on sales of previously owned and new homes. PNC Stuart Hoffman says he expects both of these reports will show gains of 3-4%.
Not a big rebound, but, you know, we've been seeing some improvement in housing since the worst of the winter weather, and I think that likely continued in May, both for brand new homes and for existing resales.
And as we mentioned earlier, we also get the final report on first quarter total economic growth in this next week. Most people are not in favor of the big proposed merger between Comcast and Time Warner Cable. That's according to a poll sought by Consumer Reports. It found that just 11% of the public supports the merger, 56% oppose, 32% had no opinion. Large majorities worried that the deal would mean higher prices. When it comes to small business, no single party owns the vote. The National Small Business Association survey finds that small business owners' party affiliations are split roughly into thirds, with slightly more affiliating with Republicans over Democrats and independents. Think you have a bad boss? A Career Builder survey finds that a majority of workers thinks their boss is doing an above-average job. Just 14% gave their supervisors the lowest ratings.
Those were people who weren't really in the loop. These were the people who felt like they were on the fringe of the team, who weren't involved in the planning, and just weren't in the day-to-day.
Michael Irwin is with Career Builder. Just over 60% said their manager deserved an A or a B. Hopefully that's yours. Well, it never hurts to remind ourselves on ways to keep our identities safe, and CreditNet.com is out with a few pointers here. Remember, those wireless networks that you find when you're away from home, say traveling, or maybe you're at a restaurant somewhere, may not be secure, so you might be exposing sensitive financial information. You'll also want to monitor your financial activity when you're out and about. Pretty easy for most of us to log into our accounts online these days and watch for anything suspicious. And some good old-fashioned advice here. Shred, shred, shred. Don't toss those sensitive documents in the trash.
Of course, shredding is more work than you think
it is at the beginning.
But now we're finding out going paperless has its own risks.
It does. If you can find one of those services that brings a truck to an area,
mm-hmm.
and you can bring tons of stuff to shred at once, you may have to pay a little bit for it. I did this in our neighborhood,
right,
where they have this truck show up at a certain spot every third Thursday. They do high-volume shredding. You just bring it and you dump it in.
All right. Good thing to know. Gina Civetti, thank you. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm John Metaxas in for Gordon Deal on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. You won't find 44-year-old laptop repair specialist Ivan Drucker vacationing at the beach. That's because he'd rather go to more offbeat destinations. In recent years, he's gone to Cuba, even the demilitarized zone in Cyprus. Drucker is from L.A. He lives in New York. He says finding beauty in decay is his thing, and so his latest destination has been Buffalo, New York. On a recent weekend, Drucker found himself standing outside an abandoned shopping mall on the outskirts of the city, snapping photos of the sprawling, blighted complex. It was shut down years ago as economic decline swept the Rust Belt city. Drucker had spent the afternoon at Love Canal, the contaminated neighborhood in the city of nearby Niagara Falls. Its main toxic waste site was abandoned in 1978 and still is a no-trespassing zone. Drucker is not alone, believe it or not. In fact, there are now tours for this kind of thing. The one that he took is called Buffalo, City of No Illusions. The tour company also leads tours to North Korea. And that's it for the Wall Street Journal this weekend. I'm John Metaxas. For Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti.